So prior to Freight Caviar, I was brokering tons of freight while my co-founder Christian was running an asset-based carrier. Both of us realized just how important relationships with shippers were. While we would go about discovering these opportunities in different ways, the few common headaches were always how much time we'd spend looking for shippers, entering the data into spreadsheets, or trying to use CRMs that were super overwhelming. We learned many of you had exactly the same experience. So about a year ago, we started building a product we'd only have dreamed of using ourselves. We call it Shipper CRM. Shipper CRM is a platform designed exclusively for freight brokers and carriers for finding, building, and managing new relationships with shippers across every corner of the United States. Every week, our shipper database gets updated with new fully researched shippers, giving back your sales team thousands of hours each year so they can focus on the important part, building successful shipper relationships. Go to shippercrm.com now, apply with your MC number for access to start discovering thousands of shippers and our amazing relationship management tools. The trucking industry is crazy right now, and being a broker can be stressful. Managing your invoices, billing, collecting, carrier base, and cash flow can feel like an impossible task. But I can tell you OTR Solutions has figured out the impossible. They eliminate cash flow problems for carrier payments and ensure margin funding in just 24 hours with broker invoice factoring. OTR Solutions takes care of billing and collection processes with your shippers. And with lightning quick and accurate invoicing, your customers will never need another broker to handle their freight needs. Kick back, relax, and let OTR take care of your brokerage. If you want to know more, and I hope you do, check them out at otrsolutions.com/freight-caviar or text OTRFC to 80483 to see what they can do for your business. We've partnered with Ascend TMS, the world's most popular anti-operated transportation management system. It's the ultimate tool for all your freight needs. You could use our referral code RA-FreightCaviar! To receive 3 months of Ascend TMS for free. It only takes 20 seconds to sign up and no credit card is required. You can click the link below to learn more.
Receive $200 off your ticket at Manifest using our link today. We are excited to once again partner with Manifest for their upcoming event, Manifest Vegas, from February 5th to 7th, 2024. Dubbed the world's largest global supply chain and logistics tech gathering, it promises a unique blend of Fortune 500 supply chain executives, fresh startups, and tech pioneers. Be among the 4,500 plus supply chain innovators. And remember, by using our exclusive link, you can save $200 off your ticket. Don't miss out.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Freight Caviar Podcast. Today's episode will be a little bit different. We'll have the opportunity to interview a shipper, and everyone seems to be always interested in learning what goes on in a shipper's mind. So we'll have a deep dive on that. Hopefully Anthony will join us here soon. He's running a little bit behind, but Marco Vargas Avila, the senior domestic transportation manager at Dole Sunshine. Thanks for joining us. Marco, how are you today?
Thanks for having me, guys. Doing well.
Yeah. Marco, I know that you've had a long experience, long tenure in logistics overall. Could you kind of just give us an introduction of how you got into the logistics space, how you got to the place where you are today?
Sure. So I'll start with a little bit about myself and how I got into logistics. I think it shaped my view of a freight center in our industry. So I'm originally from Ecuador, moved to the U.S. in 2001. So had that immigrant mindset, kind of in awe of all that is America and the opportunity here. Always had an interest just kind of understanding why, certain goods that I would look as a kid in Ecuador, like a pair of shoes at the store, Nike or Adidas, the prices would just be so different when you would go to the U.S. and see the same shoe. And so kind of happened in the back of my mind. But as I was growing up, didn't really know what I was going to do. And in college, I realized I wanted to understand business. So I studied finance and later realized that finance and econ is kind of what I'm naturally interested in, but not the accounting side of it or the super number heavy side of it. So didn't want to be an analyst building models, but wanted to understand the ins and out of how money moves in an economy and what drives a business. And so in college, thought I was going to go into Wall Street, had some Wall Street dreams, met some folks and was in some of those clubs in college around finance and trading. But ultimately, as I was heading into my senior year or the summer before, after my senior year, going into a fifth year, realized that as I was working at Bank of America, just doing retail banking and not able to break into some of the trading shops that I was looking at, that I wasn't really interested in some of the day-to-day work. It wasn't, I think, stimulating in what we were doing. Also, some of the things that you're asked to do on a day-to-day basis get pretty tedious, and you're just doing a lot of work for some folks that take credit for some of your ideas. And so young enough, early enough in my career where I had a recruiter at TQL reach out. She knew that I had some sales background, that I spoke Spanish, and they needed some help because at the time in 2012 at TQL, they didn't have a lot of people that spoke Spanish. And so with that, she goes, we'll give you a training. You'll get to work downtown Chicago. It had a cool vibe at the time, kind of reminded me of a old school trading floor. And so, you know, went through their training classes as most people do. Credit to them. They do have very good training. I think some of the best that I've heard in the industry in terms of learning the markets. And, you know, you're doing it cradle to grave. You get paired with a senior broker. And so immediately got hooked. Every day is different. You're always solving problems. You get to deal with people. And I think that's really what I enjoy. You know, the numbers that you look at on a screen, there's real people, real drivers, real companies behind them. And so I naturally fell in love with logistics then and quickly realized that, you know, applying some of the things that I learned in school around finance and econ and trading, you could look at transportation and the prices of particular lanes, similar to a stock price, not that they move like stock prices, but those concepts can be useful in determining what's the high, what's the low, what's the average, and, you know, what are the rates in the market. And so quickly fell in love with transportation then, went to a transportation asset-based carrier that had an overflow business, so Crane Transportation here in Chicago. I had a startup brokerage. I was the fourth broker hired for them. It was basically a brokerage off of an overflow business for an asset-based player. And so really got to apply some of those same learnings from both school and at TQL to help build the brokerage, which, you know, by the time I left, it was in the mid-20s in terms of revenue per year, million. I think it was 26 when I left, and this was around 2014. And as I was at Grain, I realized that, you know, there's a huge side of the market outside of the domestic side that really influences transportation, and I wanted to learn that. And an opportunity came around where a freight forwarder at the time, Damco, was building its sales program for Midwest importers for small and medium businesses. And they essentially trained me and taught me the international side of it, so the ocean, the air freight, the customs brokerage. But I was able to apply some of the domestic transportation knowledge around building inland routes to these Midwest importers to be more efficient, to, you know, save them some transit time, perhaps a little bit of cost. And so really wanted to learn both the domestic, but also the international side. And so spent some time doing business development for them originally, later moved on to transportation procurement, and ultimately was dual hatting towards the end of my tenure there as a transportation procurement manager and also a intermodal operations manager after we had centralized really drayage operations within Damco, which towards the end of it, it kind of became Maersk Logistics. And so after working at Maersk, decided I wanted to go and apply this to the shipper side. I also was looking for roles to move back to Chicago since we had our second kid and we had a third one coming. And so was able to work for Kraft Heinz, lucky enough, made it to the recruitment process. And it really got to work on transportation initiatives, transportation productivity initiatives, continuous improvement initiatives for a massive shipper like Kraft Heinz. I equate it to an analyst role, but also a continuous improvement manager role, because it was really looking at issues within that network related to transportation that we could improve. And, you know, with scale comes very different problems. With size comes a lot of different problems. And sometimes just doing the basics can really drive a lot of efficiency for a large shipper. So very thankful for my time there. Worked with some very, very smart people, some very qualified people. Got a very good view of the market. And ultimately moved over to Dole after they reached out to through a headhunter. I think Dole at the time realized that they wanted to evolve and modernize the U.S. logistics function. So that's where I'm currently at. I run and lead their U.S. logistics, everything from parcel to LTL to truckload, dry, refrigerated, and frozen, a little bit of drayage, and intermodal as well. So a little bit about myself.
Great intro. Thanks for that, Marco. I'll definitely dive into that deeper in a second. Anthony, thanks for finally making it.
24 What's minutes. Up, boys?
24 minutes doing? Slate.
We have a little bit of connectivity issues over here.
He's ahead of schedule. What are you talking about?
This is the podcast about the war in Israel, right? We're discussing that, or am I in the wrong one?
You came to
that's the other room. That's the other room.
Okay. All right. My bad. Sorry, guys.
We forgive you, Anthony. Anthony, so just going to quickly introduce you to the audience. You're the founder and president at Lionhall.ai. Can you pronounce your last name for everyone so they could hear?
My last name is Fekerata.
Fekerata. Anthony Fekerata.
Good Irish name.
Yeah, very Irish German name. Yeah. Awesome. Anthony, can you kind of, I guess, Marco just gave us an introduction of his background. I want to get an introduction also of your background and kind of tie in how you all know each other. We met Marco because of you, Anthony.
Did Marco give me permission to tie in how we all know each other?
I think we went over this actually on lunch. So do your best at okay. Do your
best. All right. So I started the industry in 2012, 2013, kind of like everybody else in this in logistics. I kind of just fell in. I was in tech sales. I have a software engineering background, dating back to elementary school, self-taught. And I was living downtown Chicago. Was tired of driving 3 hours in a car every day and commuting for my tech sales job. And I asked a buddy, Matt Williams, shout out, former Echo. And I said, hey, man, I need a sales job downtown. I don't care what it is. And he told me there's this company called XPO Logistics. They got a lot of money behind them, but nobody knows who they are. And they're hiring. They're just hiring warm bodies that can sell. And if you don't sell, they'll probably just fire you. So I'm like, all right, whatever. So I applied there. Didn't really know what logistics was, really. And that's kind of how it started. My next, I was there for about 2.5 years or something. And then my next job after that was with Marco over at Grain. 100, I think it could be 100 years old next year, right, Marco? Is there 100th year anniversary?
Those have been around for a while, yeah.
Yeah, so wow. They 100-year-old trucking company, great guys, the Grain family. They had a brokerage license that I think their father, second generation of owners, pulled out in right when freight was deregulated. I think they just kind of sat on it, and then they had the idea to bring on the really smart guy named Brad Nathan to open the shop up there and kind of just take overflow freight. So Marco was there first, and I believe it was mainly just covering just overflow that the assets couldn't handle. I think they did. I was salesperson number one, but by the time I jumped on, I think they were doing $25 million of just freight they were rejecting from their assets. And I came on and brought in. I think we brought in another 25, and that was it. Me and Marco became best friends forever. Am I skipping a few parts over there?
Well, we met at Grain, and Anthony and I, we're in our 20s in the city in brokerage. So he was lucky enough to be able to introduce me to my wife. So very thankful for that after a few nights out in the town. And, very thankful for the introduction there that has now led to a family of five.
Yeah. So every time his wife will post a picture, not every time, I'm better about it now. It's been like a decade, but every time she posts a picture on Instagram, I would just comment on it with the kids in it. I'd comment and be like, you're welcome. I've been doing that consistently for like a decade now. So, yeah.
That's funny. Okay. So, Anthony, after Grain, can you give us a little bit of background and cause nowadays I'm kind of curious what you're working on and kind of, I know it's brokerage, but let's tie this all in together to where we could have this kind of cohesive discussion about what it's like from a shipper's point of view to look at brokerages and how someone
with
sales.
With disdain.
Yeah. Well, and how can a freight broker maximize their ability to actually win business and do a good job? So I want to dive into that. So real quick, Anthony, you want to talk a little bit about what you're doing right now?
Yeah. So kind of been a gun for hire most of my career. I wanted to get into management the last couple of years because I wanted to learn how to run my own shop. And that was kind of the plan. I was hoping to do it in 2025. That's what I've had written down forever, but we're doing it at the end of 2023 in the worst freight recession ever. But so Lionhall.ai or Lionhall Trucking LLC, what we are doing is we're not, not a digital freight brokerage, just open up a traditional brokerage, but on the back of an AI model that I've been tuning since, I want to say since like March. I got the idea when Meta released Llama, like open source, and then, you know, Llama 2. And I was like, you know, I think it's easy enough. It's like friendly enough now where I could tune this myself, because I'm not like a 10X developer or anything. You know, I'm going to do enough to get by. And,
and Anthony, do you want to just share?
I didn't really think about. Okay. So my bad. You know, everybody knows when ChatGPT came out back in December. Well, it didn't come out. They've been out for a while, but this was like their public model that was like 3 or 3.5. And it kind of took the world by storm. And people have to realize those models are so much better than, like, 1 and 2 have been around forever, and Christian, as you know, but they really weren't that great. And a lot of people have had experience with them. They don't even realize it. A lot of those, like, chatbots, customer service bots you've dealt with in the past, that you're like, what is this thing talking about? Those were really GPT 1 and 2 or some kind of similar rival model to it. So GPT-4 or GPT-3 kind of like just was broke the ceiling, the glass ceiling. And then, you know, shortly after, all these other companies that have been working on stuff quietly, they all had to come out the market. So Bard, you have Claude, which was former employees of OpenAI that left to create Anthropic. They run Claude, and et cetera, et cetera. So Meta, Zuckerberg, as far as I understand it, decided, I'm going to go actually release this open source. So like other guys in GitHub, everybody can just kind of, instead of having me like, you know, 3-4, instead of being like Pepsi, Coke, and a few brands, we're just going to blow the doors wide off. And that is Llama, and then Llama 2. And basically you could just, it's its own large language model, and it's free to use.
That you can chat with, that you can
chat with. Yeah. I mean, you can,
it's deploy a kind of a personal it. Computer in a way, right?
Correct. And it's a chatbot, you know, and that's the foundation of what it is. And I started fine tuning it all year on transportation data. Just so, like, I mean, anything from like freight waves articles to, you know, sample lane data, anything, just anything that was out there that was free and I was able to use without, you know, violating any kind of, you know, proprietary data or anything like that from other companies out there. So the idea was, you know, I was going to, it was just kind of a pet project. I was going to bring it to my CTO and say, when I was like, thought it was like done or, you know, serviceable, and it just, you know, didn't work out like that. So, when the time came for me to make a move career-wise, this year, end of this year, I decided I'm just going to do it. I know how to run a brokerage. I have good customers that, I've been working with most of my career. They're serviceable. They're profitable. You know, we ride the highs and lows together. We're true partnerships. I'm going to do it. And I think I'm going to just toy around with this AI thing in the back end. And what the model is it doesn't, you know, I'm not trying to change the world. I'm not capable of changing the world with this tech, but what it is going to do is it's going to make me and my team that much better at servicing our customers. You're not going to see it. That's what I tell them. It's not a digital freight brokerage. I mean, I was really hesitant to put .ai in the name because you've seen so many companies just like say, just use tech and just not deploy any of it or deploy it poorly. And it's just given a lot, kind of a bad rap to some of these companies, but not digital freight brokers. There's nothing wrong with DFBs. I mean, there's some like Convoy, and then they changed the game. I thank God companies like that came around, because this industry, I still had customers sending me faxes in 2019. So we needed that. This industry needed a kick in the ass from some Convoys and Ubers and those sorts. But
isn't that crazy that fax is still primary method of communication?
US Bank made me send one, a fax, to confirm my identity like last month. And I was just like, you know what? I gave up. I'm like, I don't even know where to find a fax machine. I'm like, sorry, guys. I'm not banking with you.
You could send a fax via like Ring Central or like with those like Wi-Fi numbers. You could take a photo with your phone and send a fax. I used to send faxes from Ukraine to trucking companies that didn't have like, I don't know, an email to print out the packet that I would send. So, okay. Very interesting. I want to get into the shipper side of things. Anthony, you know how to get shippers, being a VP of sales, running a brokerage, et cetera. Marco, you probably, do you get like bombarded all the time, like from brokers looking to solicit business?
Every day.
Every day.
Emails, phone calls.
Okay.
Every day.
What works and what doesn't from like a broad perspective? Like have you, like in the last, like, I don't know, year, have you actually onboarded a broker that like cold emailed you or cold called you?
Absolutely. I think there is a different way that shippers approach this. You know, it depends whether you're a large one, a medium one, or a small one. You know, usually the enterprise, the super large ones, have a cycle for, you know, when procurement or the procurement teams onboards new brokers or carriers, and you just have to get into the cycle and, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's, go through the process for onboarding. But I think some of the medium or smaller shippers who value partnership with their logistics service providers are always actively looking for the right asset-based player, the right brokerage player, particularly now that those lines are getting blurred, kind of what we talked about, where, you know, assets are have brokerages. Some brokerages will rent or buy containers and broker power only moves. And so, I'm always actively looking. I don't know if all shippers are always actively looking, but there's definitely a way they, you know, sales folks can segment themselves or distinguish themselves. And obviously, learning a little bit about the company helps a lot. Understanding if you're talking to the right decision maker in the first place really matters, because sometimes you're just asking the wrong person. And so being very much prepared, but also asking, you know, polite and professional, but also asking, hey, if I'm talking to the wrong person, let me know, which will lead you down to the right decision maker at the end of the day that can get you on board. I think what distinguishes, I think for me the most, is someone that can communicate concisely and effectively and say, these are my services. This is what I do. This is where I think I could help. Let me know if you're interested. And sometimes it's just a few questions back and forth between before you get into the introduction or the initial meeting through the onboarding process. But I think someone that can package their pitch neatly in an email or a phone call that won't waste a shipper's time, particularly because we're very busy with other things on a daily day basis, I think those are the ones that open the doors. And then it's your ability to uncover a need. And sometimes that ability is just getting lucky, calling someone on a Friday when someone has bailed on a few loads and the shipper's looking for options. Sometimes it's just being determined and not overly determined, where you're kind of haunting the shipper every day, where you become annoying, but being persistent. Because I think from a shipper's perspective, if you've worked in transportation, you have to have grit, you have to have some tenacity, you have to have some hard work, and showing that consistently speaks well for that rep and ideally that company. Because if, you know, you have a fallout on a Friday, are you going to be the broker that actually recovers this or just throws their hands and gives a load back that, sorry, we'll pick it up on? And so some of the things that I've noticed that kind of stand out from, you know, called emails, called phone calls. I think the biggest piece of advice I could give is don't be annoying and don't waste people's time. Because the moment you leave a negative note with a shipper, they'll remember. Because sometimes they're not going to remember the people that did great. They're going to remember the people that kind of talked to them at the wrong time or were wasting their time or keeps, you know, calling them over and over and over. And some of those tactics, you know, probably do more harm to your sales plan than help.
What's the worst memory that you have of a tactic somebody trying to get your business?
I think when people try to get creative with the phone numbers that they call from, you know, sometimes you can blend the area codes to make it seem like it's the one right by that office, or, you know, might be your local personal cell phone number got thrown up in the internet. If you continuously try to outsmart the shipper by just kind of getting a hold of them, particularly when you're a junior salesperson, you're just really hungry, it can come across as overbearing, and you don't want to cross that line where now you're annoying. I don't even want to talk to you because I know that.
Debt collector-ish?
I think that's a good way to say it. Don't be a debt collector. Nobody likes to talk to a debt collector, but if you keep calling the same person after you've identified that they are the decision maker, it can do more harm than good. So I think having the right cadence and the right persistence, so being persistent but not annoying.
Okay.
Probably the worst tactic is just using different numbers to you know, call the same person multiple times a day.
Sure. Reed, you want to chime in?
Yeah, I've never been a shipper, so I don't know. But I imagine the inbound is like, it's these days a lot, and probably, I feel like there's a lot of really bad salespeople who use just like, either don't do any research, put very little effort into understanding to the extent that they can what you might be needing or what services you use or what kind of freight you move or whatever. And at least in my experience, it was very easy to like do some back research on a company and be able to like pick one thing that might be like a little niche about the company and then insert that into like outreach that basically just demonstrates that you aren't like a random person who's done no research or not done your homework. And that like very simple, it doesn't work every time, but like it probably increases your odds, right? Like if you ever had somebody who's, you know, reached out and they very clearly like crossed their T's and dotted their I's before they ever reached out, like, is that obvious to you?
Absolutely. I think preparation breeds some confidence, but it also comes across as being prepared and not wasting someone's time. And I think you mentioned it, you know, some sales folks just don't do any sort of research or prospecting before they just pick up the phone and start calling. And if all you're doing is just running through a list and calling, smiling and dialing, I think is what they called it when I was prospecting.
But you've worked at a brokerage. You both have worked at brokerages. Like, do you think that there's adequate, like, do you think that brokerages do a good job, you know, equipping people with like the knowledge and tools to not make those mistakes? Or do you think that the requirements of the job, like quotas or call numbers or whatever, basically encourage people to cut corners and look like morons?
I think that scale, they do not do a good job. Some are different, the smaller ones maybe, but the way I see it is kind of a numbers game. And then you're lucky if you get a good mentor down the line. My life, my career, you know, was solid, but it really took off when I had a couple different managers. You know, mainly at JB Hunt, Jim Schramm, but that's what, you know, really taught me how to solution sell. Other than just building, you know, I always use baseball analogies for salespeople in this game. So, like, you know, five tools, you know, hit for power, run for speed, hit for contact. And, you know, the first tool a salesperson should have or usually has is relationship based selling, because they kind of, you know, maybe we're good, you know, talking, you know, charismatic growing up. It was just kind of easy for them. You know, another one is persistent. Just got to be persistent. You got to be able to take a no and keep going and not take it personal. You know, just solution-based selling, strategic selling. You know, you could, I mean, there's not exactly five, you could probably make it 10 tools, whatever. You know, somebody should write a book about it. But I mean, our number one guy at my last company, I always joked that I said he had 1.5 tools, but he was, you know, pulling in 800,000 in GP a month, because he just hammered you. And Marco knows what I'm talking about, but
To add to your point though, Reed, like, do they get enough training? I think it depends on the company. And I think this is a bigger barometer or indicator for brokerages. You know, the gap between a good and a bad brokerage is massive, right? You can have all the people, all the tech, but if your processes aren't aligned and they aren't trained well, it comes across in both the service and the sales pitches. There are some brokerages that do train their salespeople really, really well. And that comes across. You're a bit more polished. You're a bit more concise. You come across as a bit more professional. But if you're just calling and you can tell that it just, you're just trying to get lucky, hoping that you can give them some freight, it sets you apart, and not in a positive way. And so I think at the end of the day, it depends on the brokerage, because I do think that there are some brokerages that do their training extremely well. You know, I know TQL doesn't have the best reputation in the market, and some of it is very well deserved to how they treat their people. But one of the things that they do well, I think, is their training and how they teach folks their to use technology to their advantage. Those training classes that I was a part of, which thousands have been a part of, you could gain a little bit of information, but if you applied yourself and you were willing to work hard, I think it is one of the best educations into freight to understand how things actually move and how to work effectively
and also how to prospect and call and be professional. And, you know, they have that cradle to grave model, which has served them well. But I think a lot of folks sometimes don't have those, that balanced skill set, and kind of go either carrier heavy or customer heavy, and the ability to kind of understand who you're talking to. Because some shippers would want to just be very conversational. Some want to be very professional. I think it's understanding what is the right approach that sets those salespeople apart and those companies apart, because they know how to reach out and who should be reaching out to the type of shipper because they've done a little bit of research before.
Can we clear one thing up? Because I'm 35 years old, been managing now for a while. We're saying call, but are we really talking about phone calls now? Because I told some of my Gen Z reps about phone, and they look at me like I'm insane. Like they don't know that the phone actually has a call feature on it. Are people actually calling you still? Or is it just getting blasted LinkedIn?
I think it's all across, right? Like emails or all social channels. Media. Okay. But you know, if you are a shipper and your number is out there in one of these CRMs, or you know, if you're signed up for DAT or something, or a Zoom info, right? Whatever the prospecting tools that are out there, you could find the shipper's direct line or their work cell phone. And so those phone calls start at 8 and they usually don't stop till like 9. And you know, there is a very distinct time of the day when, you know, they're out prospecting the brokers or the assets during time, the specific times of the day in particular time zones.
Okay. I want to also, well, now like building relationships shippers. So like, let's say, you know, Marco, like I send you an email, you like the email, we get it set up. Okay. Now we got to like start actually building a relationship. What does that look like in your point of view, Marco, of actually building a relationship with the broker? And developing it, and how does it look like for you, Anthony, to like once you secure a shipper and like actually want to like, you know, make sure that you're like buddies and good standing?
It should introduce him to his wife.
Yeah, I think how you can build a relationship with a shipper. I think after you've made it in through the onboarding process, I think it comes across as how you're implementing and how you're winning or freight, whether it be through a bid or spot shipments, and the care that you put into making sure that the first few shipments go smoothly. Because at the end of the day, what matters is the level of service or the price competitiveness of your bids. And are you doing what you say you're going to do? Do you pick up on time? Do you deliver on time? Do you bill me accurately and following the process that we've detailed in implementations? Because yeah, we want to pay you on time in full, but if you're not following some basic things like using the right reference numbers or just submitting your invoice in the right email, that kind of comes across as lazy and unprepared. And if you're not even willing to follow the basic process to get yourself paid, what are you going to do with my freight when it's, again, that Friday that falls off? Are you the broker that's going to recover it, that's going to bring back a solution and say, hey, you know, might not be able to pick it up Friday, but I can pick it up Saturday, still make on-time delivery? All of those things at the end of the day kind of paint a picture of the level of service and the quality of the processes of the company.
How do you measure that?
How to measure what?
Like the quality of the service. Is there a way that you have to measure the quality of service, or is that something that you just inherently can kind of sense like, oh, there's a problem, and you kind of just count like how many problems were there regardless of how big they were?
Dude, Marco's former craft, he's got all the KPIs down. He's got like the saber metrics of KPIs over there.
That's tied to me, but there is a lot of smart people and a lot of good people that have built a lot of great processes in terms of vendor and carrier management. So, but I think to answer your question, Christian, like for every shipper is different. And I think that's part of the research to find out like what's important to them, right? Like, do they care about on-time pickup? Do they care about on-time delivery? Do they care about not being bothered? Just pick it up and do it and, you know, rinse and repeat. So, you know, take it what I say with a grain of salt here, but I look at it two ways, qualitatively and quantitatively. You know, if you want to look at qualitative things, that's kind of where I sense your ability to communicate, your ability to implement something. And then when things go wrong, I think that's really what stands out, like how you handle when there's a rejection, when, you know, you can't get unloaded, the receiver or the shipper is giving issues. How you handle those situations is one way. I think also how you communicate, we've talked about that in communication and being proactive in your communication instead of being reactive goes a long way. Some of the qualitative things that I look for, but I also
personally, I want to speak to the folks that are doing the job to kind of gauge their abilities and also to gain a better understanding of who's ultimately moving my freight, particularly these days where there's so much fraud out there. I want to know who's picking up our freight. From the numbers perspective, quantitatively, every shipper is different. I think for me in particular in this role, you know, we are at the end of the day charged to distribute products to our customers to get them to grocers, distributors, or, you know, customers who are buying our products for ingredients in an industrial sense. But delivering to them on time, I think, is really what matters to us. We try to be a shipper that's a bit more flexible with our pickups, but at the end of the day, we want to hit that on-time delivery. And so I measure on-time delivery to the date and time, and then within a 30-minute grace period. Because at the end of the day, at least for CPG shippers, the name of the game is, you know, delivering your goods in a cost-effective manner and avoiding additional costs or unnecessary costs. And some of those costs aren't just accessorials like a lumper or a, you know, layover or detention. It might be late fines that the carrier or the broker doesn't see, because when that shipment arrives to a Walmart that is late and there's like a 3 to 5% fine to the cost of goods, you know, that's much more expensive and has a bigger financial impact to a shipper. And so for me, those are the things that I look at, you know, how you communicate, how you deal with our people, and are you ultimately delivering on time? There's other KPIs we look at, but I think that's really the main one. I mean, delivering on time so I can avoid these fines and you know, get my customers the products that they've purchased. And if you do those things, I think it gives you the ability to get additional business pretty quickly with shippers. But I think you have to prove yourself, and some shippers aren't accessible, so it's hard to do so, right? I think some are more available in open world.
Yeah. Anthony, I'm curious now from your point of view, besides the fact that Marco, you connected Marco with his wife, and all that. Let's say, how do you go on building relationships?
So touching on a lot of things Marco said, I mean, what we're doing in Linehaul is kind of just me taking what I've been learning, taking good things from the smarter people than me throughout my career, just applying them. And then the things I've seen that weren't good, not applying those. But proactive communication is number one. Accountability, transparency. A lot of this is just some things you can't fake if you just can't do it. I mean, you can't really fake integrity. I've seen companies use, I'm sure you have too, use cheat sheets about excuses and stuff like that. Like literal,
need advice. You surprised read how many people have used that with me.
Wait, which excuses? Which one? Oh, just in general or a specific one?
It's just in general. You could tell which one when it's a boilerplate excuse for someone that something told them, and if it happens continuously, you know, giving me the same excuse every single time, or not me, but the team and the people that are managing this, it comes across. And you know, I think at the end of the day, we were talking about building relationships. Honesty, I think, and transparency is key, right? Like there is no relationship if you're constantly lying. If you're trying to use, it's also basic, but it's true. Like if your marketing tactics are dubious and you're kind of skirting the line between truth and lies, I think that comes across, right?
And there's a lot of companies like that in the transportation industry that lie and don't say the truth. So.
Absolutely.
This is a shady industry. Let's just call it what it is, guys. I mean, this is just, I don't know why it is. We don't have to break it down, but it's just something about it is systemic, and people just, not everybody, but there's a lot. There's a lot of deceit. And I think maybe over the years when freight got deregulated and it comes to, brokerages just pouring in the market, I think competition just jumped up and it just became that much more of a rat race. And you see the same thing in real estate. Same idea. How many realtors are there? You know, be a big sell-off with mortgage rates this high, but market will come around again. You'll see another raise in the realtors and they just kind of get a little more sneaky and business gets a little more dirty. But it's good though, because this is another differentiator brokers can make. It's just be honest. And this is kind of coming full circle here. That sounds rudimentary, but it's just something you should do. You should just be honest, be upfront. What I've learned is that customers want to know, they just want to know what's happening and don't really not care, but they want to be aware of what's happening with their shipment. They don't want to have to reach out to you to find out. And when you're honest with them and you're letting them know, hey, even you don't have to give me an exact reason, you know, just what I'm working on right now is having the AI be able to calculate using Google Maps API, calculate how far the truck is from the shipper and then the appointment time or the continuity, wherever the drop is, and to automatically reach out and just kind of say, hey, you know, this, you know, load XYZ is being late, you know, please reply all for more details. And it seemed very simple, but I haven't been on a TMS yet that was doing that. It would automate a lot of the tracking and tracing, and then customers will know when their freight's going to be late and they can respond, and then you can jump in, you can grab the wheel when they get a response. But it's just one of the features I'm using AI for. It's clearly not, you know, groundbreaking, but it's going to be able to be more proactive in communication. And to keep answering your question, you know, how to build relationships with customers, find needs. You got to, at the end of the day, some customers and brokerages or carriers aren't meant to work together. Just don't, you know, I mean, I don't, through the last couple of years of my career, I haven't done any cross-border Mexico. And, you know, for better or worse, I've, you know, come across, you know, companies that ask me about it. And I just say, I'm not your guy. You know, I refer them to somebody who is their guy. You shouldn't have to go after everything. You should work on what you're good at. One of my biggest things is, and Marco knows this too, and I know he's big on it, is don't, just because you're a brokerage, don't bid on 99% of a freaking RFP. Stop it. You shouldn't be you should be over 50%, 50. Like, find your network, the lanes you run, take the lanes in the RFP, run them against your high volume lanes, see what backhauls you have. Bid on those. That is where you are strong. And it's the questions Marco asks people on his RFPs. He goes, why'd you bid on this? Why'd you do it? I mean, it blows my mind. I've had pricing people bid 100% of 99% of bids, and I'm the guy that has to walk in there, and they look at me and they go, what is this? Why'd you do this? And they go, when I see somebody who bids on this much of an RFP, that means they don't know what they're doing, and they're just throwing spaghetti at the wall. We want strategy. So deploy strategy, you know.
And to build on that point, I think it's using a strategy when you approach a shipper that is thought out and planned. And I think shippers are willing to give you feedback so you can refine your strategies. So at the end of the day, to build a mutually collaborative and beneficial working relationship. And the way you do that is by finding those synergies, right? As Anthony mentioned, where do you have freight already that is close to my shipping locations or my lanes that is applicable? Because whether you're an asset and you have, you know, trucks in and out of that area, or you're already running that lane and you can bolt on additional volume pretty quickly, the shipper would want to know that because it isn't a brand new lane for you. If it is one of your major power lanes as a broker and you already have the carrier base and it's deep, and you're not just posting things on the load boards to try to find capacity, where you're actively taking the time to develop the other side of the relationships, right? The carriers. I think that comes across. And, you know, we, and me in particular, like to work with brokers and assets that take the time to be strategic about where there are network synergies. And that's a word that I like to use. It might sound like a buzzword, but it's real, because as Anthony kind of mentioned, overlaying your lanes with the shipper's RFP sounds so basic, but a lot of people don't do it because I know in the industry, some large shippers have asked brokers to bid on everything because you're a broker, you can take everything. But I don't think as a shipper, that's the most sophisticated way of using a brokerage capacity, because like assets, not everybody's running every single lane in the US. Even the largest brokers just have, you know, low volume outlier lanes.
Brokerage treats their network like an asset network. And that's something I learned from working at Schneider and Hunt and, you know, having to deal with it balances, because when I was selling assets there, if I didn't have, you know, the trailers or the containers, then didn't move, then you lose a customer or might lose them. So I really started applying that towards brokerage as my career moved on. It works great. I mean, it's
how much do you guys think the proliferation of like these AI bidding tools, like, just further kind of exacerbate this problem of just bidding on everything?
Yeah. You're spot on. Real-time rating. Mark will tell you all about it.
I'll give you... So I had an interesting experience working at Kraft Heinz where they were implementing API spot pricing into the TMS. It was one of the... I don't know if it was the first, but I think it was one of the first large enterprise level shippers that was pushing their carriers to, I think, modernize and be able to quote in mass and dump it into their TMS. And it started with, I think, original five, and then later branched out to, you know, upwards of 30 plus. Like, who knows how many they have now. But I think the brokers that have that capability, that technological savvy or process to be able to adjust and pivot and provide that pricing. It isn't just how you quote the rate, but then how you dump it into that individual TMS and all of the technicalities there. But I think you see a grouping effect, because if you're just using DAT or if you're just using sonar, it becomes pretty clear as someone that's looking at all of those numbers that the same line haul amount or the same all-in rate or the same rate per mile kind of gets grouped together. And the folks that are just kind of spraying and praying or just dumping a bunch of rates to an RFP that are using kind of the same tools kind of get grouped together. And so I think that's where the qualitative pieces of it come into play, where if everyone is pricing it at the same, what's going to separate you between you and four other, you know, brokers at the same exact rate? Is it going to be that relationship, that understanding of your service and your quality? And so I think the proliferation of these rating tools has caused a lot of, I think, maybe making brokers a bit more commoditized, because before that pricing methods were a bit more manual or individual to these companies, whereas now a lot of them are using the same tools and you see that come across. And it is, like Anthony mentioned, something that stands out in an RFP from a shipper side, where, you know, if a shipper has to question whether you're bidding on everything and you're the number one bid on every single lane, are they just paper rates? Do they just need to be ignored? And do they just need to be considered an outlier? And very often we remove them.
And you Marco, know, how is that something to, from an, how can you help us understand why 99 bidding on 99% of the RFP is bad? I can have my reasons, but could you explain to?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it shows that you aren't specifically targeting lanes where you are more likely to succeed, where you likely won't fail within the first 3 months of the rate being implemented because you just underquoted it and have to give the lane back. And so when you bid on everything, it shows that you're just hoping to pick up some business, but that you didn't actually take the time to prepare a strategy of what you wanted to bid based on what you think you could be most competitive in. And also, I think it shows a bit of you know, lack of sophistication in terms of how you're approaching these bids. I think that's the perception that it gives me personally, and I've spoken to other shippers that I know say the same thing. But again, it's just my opinion. I know other shippers do ask others to bid on everything.
Would you ever actually give out 100% of an RFP to a single provider of a service? Is that a big risk for you?
No, not a full RFP, but I think like a lane or a core group of lanes you would, right? But it's just too high of a risk for a shipper to kind of put all his eggs in one basket.
Every broker who's ever bid on an RFP has gotten an award back where they got way more than they thought they were going to get. And they're like, oh, shit. Like, what am I going to do? Like, that's happened to everybody.
Yeah, especially with the two round bids where you get round one back and you're like, you're green on a lot. You're like, oh no, I really thought I went there. That's good. Generally most bids are two rounds and at least nowadays. And anytime I'm in a bid, if I get the chance, the opportunity to have a discussion with them in between rounds, like a call. And most of these calls that people have is just kind of like, yeah, we do this lane real good. You know, we'll do that one real good for you. How much do we have to sharpen the pencil to grab that one? Like, what I started doing was making Power BI dashboards, literally just using an Excel formula that I was telling you guys about, taking high volume lanes against the high volume lanes on the bid that match the synergies, as we call them. And just a Power BI dashboard, share my screen, quick 15 to 30 minute call. And then so on one screen, it would show a flow map of all, you know, just for visual effects, showing like, you highlight the lane on the on the data table and it would show like the lane on the map visually. And then kind of just showing how many times we ran it. You know, so say the RFP runs this lane 500 times a year. Well, we run this backhaul, you know, 140 times a year. So it might be, you know, a good idea to give us a piece of it. You know, clearly we can't handle 100% capacity like that. I would say if a shipper is running, if a broker is running a lane 1,000 times the backhaul of it, then you need to be, for you to give 100% of your allocation to a brokerage on a lane, they need to be running that in reverse times two. That's kind of a more simpler way to put it, because you're really putting a lot of eggs in one basket for a high volume lane. I know Marco, he splits his, correct me if I'm wrong, you split your high volume lanes to primary A and primary B, right?
I mean, I can't tell you all my secrets, but there is a routing guide design is very much something I like to talk about, but it is very specific to every shipper and it really talks about strategy. I think, you know, it really varies by the lane, but you know, most shippers these days don't just have one primary and maybe a backup. I think they kind of take a bit more thought and care about how they build and how they stack, maybe multiple primaries with multiple backups, and you split the lanes based on volume percentages or your loads per day or loads per week. So the TMS is pretty sophisticated these days to customize how you want the routing guide to be designed and the tenders to flow.
I'm curious, is price always like the most important factor when you're looking at RFP? Like, what do you look like? Is that what you're looking at mostly, Marco?
No, I think it's always a balance of price and performance. And when I say performance, I mean service off for me. And it's really like on time delivery. But when it comes to price, I think it's, you have to be competitive to the market. And I think maybe this is an area where the assets, because they're different than brokerages, they have a fixed cost, you know, aren't as flexible or in tune. Whereas if, you know, you're overbidding on something by, you know, $1 a mile or $500, you know, dollars on the line haul versus, you know, not the lowest rate, but maybe the bottom 10, you're just too far apart from where the market is at that point in time to be considered for an award. Now, is price the most important? No, but it is one of, you know, the top two or three things that you need to consider. But service, I think, is something where you could distinguish yourself as a broker. And kind of the things that we've talked about, how you communicate, how you present yourself, are your people prepared, how you handle those rejections and returns or that Friday, you know, afternoon fallout, right? All of those things, I think, help distinguish a broker to ultimately be able to ask for a bit of a higher rate. But if you're trusted and your service is proven that you can deliver, then I think you're more likely to get that award even when you're not the lowest. However, you know, we've been coming off of a, you know, historic, you know, deflationary cycle from the COVID boom and you know, the recessions that we're in right now, freight-wise. And so I think being in tune to the market is important, because if you're constantly pricing based on the rates that were 3 months ago and you're not aware that we're in an up or down cycle, you're just not setting yourself up to succeed. And so that's where price matters, right? Like, are you so far apart that I can't even consider you? Or are you within the range? And that range is, you know, every shipper has their own range. There's different data sources for it. But you know, I think that's what separates the good versus the bad brokers, or even a good one versus a great one. The planning and the thought before you input that number.
So, Anthony, how do you come up with the rate?
Come up with the rate? Well, good data. I rely a lot on good data. I've been a avid subscriber to Green Screen the last couple of years. Big fans of those guys over there. I like what they're doing. Over the years, I've complained about the rates that were available, the tech that was available to us. You know, and not saying there's bad tech like that, and Sonar's great, but a small brokerage, or even a medium-sized brokerage, like me and you used to work at, we don't buy like CH. We don't buy like Coyote. We never will. And we don't have that kind of, you know, buying power in the market share, you know. So I like those tools that show me how we're going to buy. And then as far as, you know, how I specifically bid for like RFPs versus spot, you know, spot's easy. If you got a brain, spot's easy to do. RFPs, you know, there's no exact science on how to do it, but you're going to have a hard time screwing up if you bid on the lanes you're already running. because you've been a carrier rep. You call these guys first. I mean, you source a bit. Nobody should be even putting numbers into an Excel spreadsheet without even talking to your carriers first. You know, if you're seeing a lane running 2,000 times a year and you're trying to get, you're trying to get like a 156 of those loads. That's 3 loads a week. That means you could probably get 1 trailer dropped. You know, that's another thing we haven't even talked about in this call. When I call a shipper and they say, "So we only work with assets," I go, "Why? Why do you only work with assets?" And usually it's like, "Well, I need drop trailers." I go, "I can drop trailers." Like, really? A broker can drop trailers? I'm like, "Yeah, you know, depends on the region. I'm not gonna be able to drop trailers for you in Idaho, you know, but Southeast, Freight Alley, yeah, I can drop trailers just about anywhere. Chicago, where I'm from, yeah. LA, you know, so it's strategy. When I, Marco's old boss over at Kraft, when we heard, you know, RFP time, you know, we was like sitting down and like horse trading, and she needed something in Columbus, she needed to go to Atlanta, and we sat there and we just talked about how many trailers we can drop and kind of the continuity of the entire network. So if you're afraid about giving paper rates, don't just solely rely on the tech, talk to your carriers. It's just that easy. It takes a little bit more work though, a little bit.
Yeah.
Or talk to your carrier reps if you're not running the whole show.
For sure. Yeah. That's good. Good intel. I'm wondering, just this from a marketing standpoint, if you're a broker, is there something besides like a nice cold email, cold phone call that a broker could do for a shipper? Like maybe sending like a funny gift or like, I don't know, like, is there something more creative that they could do to get like noticed? And have you seen any good examples of that?
Yeah, I think it's humor, you know, always plays well. If you can make somebody laugh, you're more likely to have a conversation and start off on the right foot. So concise in, you know, those emails, I think matters, right? You know, nobody wants to get, you know, paragraphs of in the 4-page book to just read on, right? Like that might go into the junk mail before the grief fat. But I think also understanding who you are reaching out to, right? Doing a little bit of something from the individual beforehand. I think it goes a long way. You know, for example, if you can look up an individual's social media, if they're online, right, and you notice what they're liking or what their interests are, if you know they're a big college football fan or a big baseball individual, or they have a unique background. I think that goes a long way in opening up the conversation, showing that you just didn't take a pre-made, you know, sales pitch that you learned in training and you're just repeating it every single time. That goes a long way.
Speaking of social media, Reed, are you on social media?
So I think just to give you an example, I had one individual broker who would film videos, and I think he had a background in film.
Okay.
And they would be short. There'd be like a minute. But his entire minute little elevator pitch was like, why should you work with me and why I want to work with you? And, you know, I won't mention their name, but, you know, they used the same tactic at Kraft Heinz. They used it at Dole. And I think those videos do get sent and spread within those transportation teams if they're funny, or those memes if they're funny. And if you can make someone laugh and put a smile on their face when, you know, everything's not going the right way, you're more likely to be able to get onboarded and given a shot. And then it's up to you to determine what do you do with that opportunity.
Yeah, it's people in this industry are so obsessed with scale and like how they do things like at scale. And at the end of the day, like when you're a shipper, you have no idea who somebody is and they're hitting you up continuously. Like that's just that's a one of one situation right there. And like you're dealing with individuals who are each, you know, nuanced and have different interests and have different inclinations and prefer different things. And it's just so hard to, especially as a broker where you don't have really anything to hang your hat on with somebody who doesn't know who you are, right? You can't say, oh, we've got 1,000 trucks. All you can say is, oh, we provide really good service. Like those are just words when somebody doesn't know you. And the question is, like, how do you, like, there's so much about a broker that, like, you literally can't know. Like, you can't know the quality of a brokerage until they've actually done work for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's so much to be discovered that can only be discovered through experience. And brokers, like, how does a broker really differentiate themselves on the surface, but when you have no idea who they are? Like, I just said a bunch of stuff, but yeah, I mean, but that's seriously like how is there marketing that's like really, you know, actually effective?
Let me cut you off. I say a picture's worth like 1,000 words actually means something. One thing I started in this market, you had to find ways to get creative. And we haven't even talked about Christian could probably elaborate a little on this a little bit. Domain reputation. I'm just getting super nerdy here, but a lot of your emails not only don't go into like other, or they go into junk, or sometimes the firewall from Microsoft or whatever they use, Google, they just blocks it. And there's that means that could not even be your fault. That could be the guy next to you who just spams the same email over and over again, or does mail merge. He's ruined your reputation, and now all your emails go into. So, you know, I've seen that a lot, but let's assume the email does get through. If you know for sure where a shipper, their network, like where their big DCs are, and you have some synergies, just a smaller picture, not massive, but a smaller picture on the bottom of your very concise, like Marco said, outreach, just two sentences, three sentences, real short. And then a photo just showing like, listen, these are our network lanes. Just, you know, try to make it, don't draw it yourself on MS Paint, but maybe go on, you know, My Maps, you know, My Google Maps or something like that. You don't have to make a dashboard and just show, you know, they'll do it for you. Type in the cities, they'll show the lanes, say, hey, this is our lanes, and just something to grab their attention. I mean, go look at anybody who has LinkedIn, look at your posts that, and then look at the engagement on them, and you'll see you could write the most, you know, the wittiest thing, and with no photo, you usually aren't going to get them anywhere near the amount of engagement unless you put a photo.
Say on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah. Instagram's only photos, but
so just apply that towards your sales emails, you know? But, you know, maybe make them a little relevant.
Visuals in an email do go a long way, whether it be a visual of, you know, your network, or where you have a map of where you have your assets from your terminals, or like, you know, someone did a great analysis and mapped out every single lane you run last year, and you have that shown. You know, as Anthony mentioned, a picture, you know, says 1,000 words. You can add a picture or a screenshot of something within your email, whether it be a meme or something, or, you know, some visualization of data to grab that shipper's interest. And I think that goes back into the research. Like, do you think they're more likely to be more witty or like the humor, or are they very data driven and that's what they want to see? They care about the numbers. But I think you can differentiate yourself with marketing. But I think one of your other guests has mentioned it in the past, but you know, in freight brokerage, marketing can be a double-edged sword where it could come off as lies, but it could actually drive value by allowing you to open the door that you perhaps wouldn't have had an opportunity to open just because you had that funny meme or you had that great piece of analysis. And so that does help, you know, give thought about crafting your cold emails, because you never know when you're going to get lucky and someone's going to open it and you'll get a reply.
What's a bad example of broker marketing?
everything else.
Formatting in your emails. I think when you can tell that it's just copy paste it from before, or you're putting everyone in a blind carbon copy email that, you know, just says, hello, friend, like, let me know how I can help you in this area. You know, when it just becomes a cookie cutter approach every single time, that's when they stand out. And, you know, you're less likely to get a response. But again, that's just my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I get emails for the Freight Caviar email address, like from people soliciting business for me, thinking I'm a shipper. Obviously, they did no research. It's just like copy and paste. I automatically just report them as spam. So it's hurting their domain, email domain. Yeah. I mean, it's literally like it's the most awful email in the world. On the shipper CRM email, all I get is like these tech sales emails of people wanting me to outsource, you know, like programming out to other like companies.
And dude, I just got an email from a dude at like saying he was a white hat hacker, and saying basically like, if you want to employ us, it was like almost threatening that he was like,
I will hack you.
We're going to do an SQL injection on your site, like, unless you respond to his email.
They want to do a penetration test, see if you have any exploits.
But it was like, the way it was worded was like threatening. And I was like,
Reed, I'll do that for you for free.
Yeah. I'll
hack your site for free. Okay. We discussed a lot about like building relationships, getting in with shippers. I do want to change to talk a little bit more about this year, 2023. This episode might come out in the early 2024. So kind of recap 2023. Convoy bankrupted, Yellow bankrupted. Can we talk a little bit about the impact that had on the shipping side, on the freight brokerage side? And also, what are we looking at in terms of rates? Are we going to see an improvement in 2024? People are talking about a soft landing, and economically speaking, how will that affect transportation?
I think, Marco, you mind if I start?
Nope.
You know, this is where I call Marco and sit on the phone for an hour yelling about the market every single day. So, okay. Today is December 5th, 2023. We don't know when this is going to come out. We've seen in the last 7 days, 10 days, a dramatic spike in rates. I think it's the first time maybe since like March of 22 this has happened. I've seen some articles written about it. I haven't had a lot of time to read articles lately, but it can't go unnoticed, that's for sure. I mean, things I was covering for, you know, out of California, Illinois, Northern California, I was covering for like 3,000 and covering for like 3,800. I mean, a lot outbound Chicago is super hot right now too. Now, is it a blip? Is it just like some weird seasonality? Usually the Christmas rush happens a little bit earlier. It's kind of slowed down by now, but it's going up. I don't know. I think it will slow down. I think the Morgan Stanley's research back in earlier in the year said rates would start to bottom out in spring, flat until summer, and then around July and August, we would see a tiny increase. But instead of going down after Christmas, they were going to continue to go up, but not, you know, just kind of gradually go up and then into normalcy in later 2024. Obviously, that has not happened whatsoever. Rates have been just dropping since fall, or excuse me, since spring. What I think is going to happen, I think we're in for a year of shit. I think it's going to be another year of just steady. It's going to be, I think next year is going to be a lot like 2019 still, just flat. People don't remember this, but 2018 is when rates started to go down. And then 2019, they kind of just sat there. And kind of what happened this year, I think it's going to happen again. And the reason why I talk about soft landing, I don't think we're going to get a soft landing. I'm not an economist, but nobody knows the stuff for sure. I think the other shoe hasn't dropped on the U.S. economy. I think we've, you know, without trying to get political here, I think we have the last three presidents, I don't care who you're red or blue, they've all done the same thing. They have kept interest rates low to make the stock market high. Because most Americans think, oh, high stock market means good economy. It doesn't. It's not a sign of a healthy economy. But those are the people that vote. So our politicians have kept interest rates down. And, you know, what goes up must come down. If you ever drank too much one night, however high you went up drinking, generally you feel the equal amount shitty the next day. This freight market, 2021, come on. I mean, it was great if you were a broker, but we're feeling the inverse of that now. And the U.S. economy, we've had from 2012 to 2022, just riding a high on low interest rates and free money. And we are, it's time to pay the piper. And we're not getting over it this quick, I don't think. I could be wrong. I don't know.
So nobody has a crystal ball, right? I think if they did, even some of the smartest people in the industry that, you know, have skin in the game and make their forecasts public. In the last 2 years, we've been saying that rates are going to go up in 6 months, it'll go up in 3 months, it'll go up in a year. No one really knows. However, I think it's important to understand some basics around freight and transportation, and then that it has a business cycle. You could look at a line chart of just prices or overall spend, and you could see those, you know, those peaks and those valleys. You could see that line chart go up and down, right? A lot of that, I think, was driven in this last cycle by the Fed announcing that they were going to increase interest rates and how much of an impact that's had everywhere, whether it be housing, whether it be venture capital and their funding rounds and the ability for carriers and other startup brokerages to access capital, right? And so that, I think, was the signal where it was in November of 21, I want to say, when the Fed announced rates will start going up, and nobody really knew how much they were going to go up, right? But A, that was a signal that things were going to be changing. With that, those booms that we saw in COVID that have now started decreasing, and as Anthony kind of mentioned, for every upswing, there's a downswing in a sense. Well, I think we're in the middle of that downswing coming from, you know, historic market, perhaps one of the highest markets we've ever seen in 2020 post-COVID boom. And so when that happened, I think there were some players in the industry that kind of had issues, profitability issues in the past, and there were rumors in the market of whether they would be able to continue. Yellow was one of those assets that, you know, for a while had been on the verge of bankruptcy, and you know, I'm not an insider there, but they had to tap into the federal government, gave them a loan during COVID for them to stay open. And so an LTL carrier has a much different dynamic than a broker, but I think we saw the Yellow bankruptcy happening, and we noticed it from a shipper side just based on how aggressive they started getting in their bids. We used to work with Yellow both as an LTL carrier, but also their brokerage, right? They had a Yellow Logistics, and I think a telltale sign of when a broker is in trouble is when you notice a drastic change in their aggressiveness of their pricing. Whereas before, they might have been middle of the pack, and now they're really treating bids like a, you know, like bidding on everything and everything. You know, they're their number one price carrier for everything. That's a red flag, right? Because it's screaming that you're looking for volume and something else is happening there. Saw something similar with Convoy, you know, a few months before they actually went down. With Yellow, I think they had a different impact into the market because LTL is a very different market. It's not truckload, the way it's priced, those carriers, the pricing strategies, how heavy of fixed costs they have is completely different.
So much overhead.
Yeah.
And with Yellow, their bankruptcy, I think, ultimately was an inflationary, on LTL, was an inflationary driver or a shock to the market because LTL rates post-Yellow bankruptcy, which is still being resolved, did cause LTL rates to go up. And I saw it. We were in the middle of kind of redesigning some of our LTL routing guides, and some carriers were willing to provide some pricing. And shortly after that bankruptcy, you started hearing, we're freezing all of our pricing or discounts that we're getting. And I think that LTL capacity will come back to the market after this bankruptcy is settled, right? Whether it be the terminals, the assets, or even those drivers. And so it had a bit of a spike, but did it last? I don't think so, because the macro trend, going back to the Fed and interest rates, you know, they're trying to slow it down. They're trying to prevent overheating, right? They're trying to prevent inflation from going too high, which is why they raise interest rates. And so they're trying to slow it down. And when you have such a powerful entity in the markets like the Fed, you know, there's that saying, don't fight the Fed for a reason. There's no way you're going to go against the tide when the Federal Reserve is saying we need to slow things down, right? They have more money. They have more power in the market to be able to drive the outcome that they want, because they are not a regulator, but they're a key market player that drives the direction of the market. And so understanding that dynamic is important, and you saw it with Yellow. With Convoy, I think it's different. I think with Convoy, they were, to their credit, I think one of the brokerages that when they were coming up, pushed the industry forward at a time when the industry wasn't ready to modernize, we talked about faxes earlier, right? Like they came in and were pushing shippers and carriers to start using technology to their advantage in an industry that is, you know, I say conservative in the small C, they're not open to change. They like the ways that they work. And at the time, you know, why do I got to fix it if it ain't broke? Well, because there's better ways of working. I think they showed that both to shippers and brokers that there is a value in creating technology that drives efficiencies. However, for them, I think they got caught up in that boom of VC money and unrealistic valuations that ultimately drove them to make decisions that when for us, a basic broker or someone that's been in the freight industry, you know, staying profitable is fundamental. It is the one thing you have to do in order to continue your business. And I think they got perhaps a little bit too punch drunk in their idea that they would be able to tap capital markets and funding like they used to be able to do in the early stages. And when the Fed starts increasing rates and you're not profitable and you're dependent on other people's capital, those interest rates are going to impact because it's going to make your cost to borrow so much higher. And when you combine that with their burn rates in terms of how much they were spending in the engineering talent and the marketing talent and their people, they didn't get caught up in the market in that the market started going against them. Their burn rates were too fast. They weren't able to cut enough people fast enough to be able to stay profitable. And ultimately, at the end of the day, they had to shut it down. And there were other players that had been in there, but they did ultimately, I think, innovate. And I think in the history of freight, it's going to be one of those brokers that pushed the industry forward. And a lot of great people have come out of that company. However, it's sad, in my opinion, it's a bit sad to see that player go because ultimately they were one of the I don't know if it's a pioneer, the right word to use, but they were one of those brokerages that was pushing to modernize an industry that at the time didn't want to. And while they did create great technology and they had great people, that just wasn't enough to offset higher interest rates and the lack of profitability.
It would have been nice to see them finish what they started. There's been a lot. I don't want to beat a dead horse. There's been so much content about Convoy, but I'll say one thing. I think my connection is cutting out there.
You're good. Oh, now we're good. Yeah.
Sorry, Mike. I stopped talking. I saw it cutting out. The one thing, Andrew Silver and Paul Strada, their podcast, Freight Pod, they did the best content, the best value I got was their one with Bill Dreigert.
It was not a Flexport.
It's a Flexport. But listen to him talk about just about tech in our industry. He's an Uber guy, and he gave his thoughts on Convoy and why he thought they went down, and what he thinks the value tech's bringing into the industry, and like kind of he talked a little bit about his spouse been on it's a little too hard, where a lot of these guys have great ideas and they do, but the industry as a whole just wasn't ready for it. And I've been just talking to Marco about this the other day. I called us at midnight. I called him ranting. Like, I've been on the customer sales side my entire career. I've never been on the carrier sales side. We did a lot of cradle to grave back in the early XPO days, but started my own brokerage. Only have like a handful of employees. So I'm doing a lot of everything right now. And it's funny, you sit in the customer sales side, you're at a steakhouse or dinner, you're talking about tech, and then you're thinking like, wow, the industry's really come a long way. And then you go back to the carrier sales side of things and you're like, oh man, we are so far from being there right now. It was just a lot of resistance to adapting. I mean, I was on the freight broker Reddit the other day, just kind of perusing, and the amount of hate toward the new DAT load board, DAT 1, versus DAT power. I mean, for no reason. I just like, what's the reason why? People just, they don't like change. Most people don't.
What's interesting, I you mentioned in that episode of the Freight Pod, I actually had this conversation with Ryan Soskin from the chip who worked at Coyote and worked at Convoy and started his own company, where it was just having some rapport before a proper call. And one of the things I mentioned is like, I would always be interested in seeing Convoy and Flexport be put together because I felt like they were such complementary businesses for each other because of the focus on freight forwarding and the international aspect of logistics versus the focus that Convoy had and the domestic side of it. And it's crazy how just things ended up where I remember mentioning to him just as a joke, like, I think those two might merge or something might happen prior to all of these bankruptcies that happened because all of these companies that were having layoffs because they have to cut their burn rates and costs. And it's just funny enough that, the guys in the center of this market, Bill now gets to, with the experience that he's had both at Amazon and Uber Freight and now at Flexport, gets to basically, hopefully finish and embed something that I think was a great need for the industry and a play that I think will go down ultimately in the history books is one that pushed the industry forward. It forced us to get better. It forced
brokers to be better. It forced shippers to take technology and analytics more seriously in how they look logistics. And
competition is good for the marketplace.
Yeah. And ultimately, there are going to be other, call it innovators and disruptors in freight and in logistics. And I think I'm eager. I'm actually very excited to see what's going to come up out of the, you know, this recession, because typically some of the best businesses get built in down times. And so that is, kind of a long answer to your question. I think maybe we could go back to where we think the market will go to here.
I see Anthony raise his hand.
I don't want to interrupt, so I was just try to do it the right way here. I had a question for you guys. What Marco said about continuing to innovate. Do you guys think we will see less of that now that rates are so high, interest rates are so high and so hard to get capital?
No. Getting capital is not how you innovate, like, at all. It's certainly powder to do it, but it's not the only way. And in fact, it's getting capital and being obsessed with capital is what's blown up a lot of companies.
I'm bootstrapping. I'm playing little devil's advocate.
I think people will be more focused on becoming profitable, which obviously you need to in order to have a functional business. So I think at the end of the day, we will still see a lot of innovation and people wanting to change the industry, because that's more like a personal like characteristic of people, right? Like that, like they're motivated to make a change and an impact, and that won't change. So,
think about the barrier to entry to building in this industry, right? Like, it is, what are these guys spending money on? Like, when they raise all this money, what are they spending it on? And how do you reduce the need? Like, a lot of it is sales and marketing, frankly. And when you come in and you start building, it's like you're essentially starting from zero, and you're dealing oftentimes with folks who've never worked in the industry, right? Which is a huge problem in and of itself.
That's all he talks about. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't understand the fundamental issues. And a lot of them see, big numbers from like a TAM, what's the TAM? Like, the TAM's huge, but like, it's a trap, right? Like, that's a trap.
Logistics became such a hot thing in 2021. Dude, I swear to God, I had a girlfriend, no, this is no joke, in 20, for COVID, that literally, like, 2 months I dated her. I swear to God, she thought I was a truck driver. Like, she's a logistics, freight broker, she thought I was a truck driver. After 2020, after COVID, everybody's like, dude, you're logistics? You're going to make so much money. I'm like, okay, man, thanks. Where were you?
I do.
But it became a hot industry. We saw it in 20. After 2017 with like Hurricane Irma and like just big spike in rates, and then all this PE money came in, but it didn't go to brokers. It really went to trucking companies, and you saw the big sell-off on those way back in like 2019. And then I think this time we saw it with brokerages. A lot of PE money going to brokerages. I mean, Paul, we know one that got some, and a lot of these brokerages now are it's just tough, man. It's tough to do, These companies went and just hired so many people because they just kept going up, 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 up. And as Americans, as humans, we're almost like, we always want to keep advancing, keep growing. Like, if it's not good to say you're a company and it doesn't grow up, you're like, wait, stagnant? Like,
yeah.
What if you want to be stagnant? What if you want to just stay profitable and enjoy your summers in Capri,
It's a riskier environment overall. So just all that capital that was coming in to allow these companies to take risks to drive change into the market. Yeah. Because already entrepreneurs would come in and they want to make an impact on the world, and they're viewing it from the standpoint of like, okay, in order to push and force this change, we're going to have to literally pump money into it. And that I kind of always looked at the Convoy thing in that similar sense, which was that, Dan and co-founder, I forgot what his name was, but they knew that that change needed to come, that venture money is looking for a home, right? Like, there's an entire market of for venture capital, and they're looking to place that money somewhere. So at times when it's a really good economic environment, those two things just come together, and I think those are one of the biggest forces that actually push the innovation forward. And Anthony, to your in an industry, and Anthony, to your point, I think right now we might see less of it, just simply because a lot of the things are just so tied to the Fed And there's just less access to capital. It's more expensive to borrow capital right now. And so it's kind of like the downstream effects of these risk takers getting capital to do something with is we're just going to see a lot less of it. But on the counter side to that, at least this is just my opinion, but there is a new step change in the world right now. And it's these chat models that you were talking about earlier. And what they're able to do is something that I think can be applied to an industry like logistics, that can open up avenues that never were able to be touched before. And all of logistics, as we talked about before, is operated on fax, email, all these things, which really the common point there is language, making it like a really a perfect, not a storm necessarily, but a perfect time for a lot of innovation to be driven in logistics. You know, maybe low-level innovation, right? Like just like how you're doing with line haul, back office automation, make the business more efficient so that you can make it profitable faster, right? And kind of do more with less people, with less resources. And I think there's going
to
be this renaissance.
And this all is supposed to be, this is what the guys in the All-In Pod talk about. Like it's not supposed to put people out of a job. You know, we're talking about AI now. Just, it's supposed to make you more, you know, it's supplemental, you know, it's gonna make you more productive. And that's really all it is. We've seen this before in different, you know, with the Industrial Revolution, you know, with the assembly line and things like that. It didn't, you know, people just didn't lose their jobs. They just got repurposed.
Most jobs don't exist that existed like in the 1930s. They just have changed, evolved.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And going back to what Ree was talking about, it blows my mind, like seeing what you guys are a perfect example, like all the three of you, with all you've done with marketing and like, what's your marketing budget? You know, like these companies that come out there, and I'm not trying to badmouth anybody, but I heard like, you know, like Flock was like the money they were spending on, I could be wrong here, but I heard that the money they're spending on marketing was just crazy. And I'm thinking like, Frick Caviar, Lost Freight have made a bigger impact as far as they've made a bigger splash marketing wise than them. And I bet you their marketing budgets are almost $0. I mean, you guys are doing it all yourselves. So I think in this day and age, like you don't need to spend money on, I mean, it depends what your industry is, but what we're doing, what we're all trying to do, just get out there and just be engaging. And these people that are using AI apps or just any app to like be charismatic, use this app to, you know, make up conversations with people on LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. I'm like, are you nuts? Like, listen, you know, you just, maybe talking to people isn't your thing if you need an app like that. Maybe you should do something else. Yeah. But it's a testament to you guys how far you've come and how many people know about you outside of logistics just from just kind of just going on LinkedIn and talking shit on Twitter.
Thanks for that, Anthony. And guys, unfortunately, we do have to wrap up here. We have another meeting to get to. But thanks for doing this. This was great. I think we'll have to do part two soon if you're up for it. We could do it in person. Yeah, in person. I'm down to do it in person. Okay, in person in January.
I spent $5,000 on audio and video equipment. I didn't have time to set any of it up.
All right. Well, perfect. We'll get it set up.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Awesome.
No, it's been great. I appreciate the time and the conversation. And I think you guys are, you know, also innovating in your own sense, kind of what Anthony has mentioned. So keep up the good work and you know, pushing the industry forward to really innovate and rethink their ways of working, because I think this industry is fascinating because of this dynamic where you can be both, you know, blue collar and white collar, but also be very conservative in your ways of working, but also very modern in your ways of working. And the dynamics and the differences between companies and how they do the same thing, they're just moving goods from A to B, is fascinating. So I've always appreciated seeing you guys from the sidelines and in the arena doing your own thing. And so keep up the great work.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you. I giggled a little bit because Anthony was showing his Zen at the camera then. Sorry. So
lower and upper.
All right, guys. Well, have a great Tuesday. Thanks for coming on. And until next time.
See you guys.
See you guys. Bye. See you guys. Bye. See you guys.